Here is The Place, Our City. It's a special concert coming up this Friday at NJPAC in Newark, a collection of stellar artists gathering for the spirited premiere of Ade Gokay Steve Coulson's Jazz Flavor Tribute, commissioned by NJPAC in honor of Newark's 350th anniversary. And my guest was born right here in Newark. Ade Gokay Steve Coulson is not only a wonderful pianist, but he's an educator and a Bloomfield College professor. Ade, thanks for joining us. I know that this concert, Here Is the Place, Our City, is being dedicated to two of your closest friends who passed away. The wonderful historian from Rutgers University, Newark, Dr. Clement Price, and the great poet Amiri Baraka. How did this all start?
Well, actually, Clem Price got in touch with me because this was back in 2012, I guess. 2013 was the celebration of the Emancipation Proclamation, and he wrote an article. I think he called it that in that great getting up morning, something like that. So he sent me the article, and so he called me and we talked about it on the phone. And then he said, he would be interested in finding out if I would like to start to compose something regarding the Emancipation Proclamation. And so we were talking about it for a while, but then as it turned out, 2015 was fast approaching. And so he was looking forward and he was saying, well, you know what, actually, you know, Newark is getting ready to go into another situation. So at the time I was talking to him, it was also approaching the AACM's 50th, which was, we started in 1965. So 2015 was another nexus for that. So the time had passed for me to do the Emancipation Proclamation, and it was moving on to this period because he was well aware of the 350th anniversary also of Newark. So we went past that date, and then he started to concentrate on the 350th, and he suggested my name to the committee. And so then it developed from there. So, but I had actually been talking about some of the ideas that went into this project back with him in 2013.
Tell us about the event exactly coming up on Friday at NJPAC. What will people be able to see, and what do you want them to learn?
Well, the piece, I'm trying to sculpt a piece that deals with the long history of Newark. It's the third oldest major city in the United States. And so it's got a long history, a lengthy history. And so I'm trying to have us kind of take a panoramic view of that history through music. And then I'm also having the North Jersey Philharmonic Glee Club. So we do have words and text involved. But, you know, over the long arc of the piece, I'm trying to get various styles, and I got some really great musicians to do that. So we have another rehearsal tomorrow, and then we look forward to the piece on Friday.
Can you give us a brief list of the musicians working with you?
Yeah, really some great musicians. And I've worked with them all at some other point. But my rhythm section, I have Firon Akhlaf. We've worked together for many years. Great drummer. And then I have on bass, Mark Elias, great bassist. These people have played internationally with, you know, everybody from A to Z. Guitar player is Kelvin Bell, really great guitar player. And so we've been together on a number of occasions over the last 5 years or so. And then I also have a person that is really a really great trumpet player, is really developing as well. He used to attend sessions that I used to run with Chris White up at Montclair State. We had a program called the Joy Program, Jazz Opportunity for Youth. So his name is Nabate Isles, and he's really turned into a really great musician. So the other person in the immediate jazz band is Bradford Hayes. He's taught in Newark, and he's a really great musician from in and around this area. He plays around here quite a bit. And so those are that's the jazz component, but I also have two classicists. I have Oscar Petty on oboe. He's just got a PhD from Rutgers. the first African American to get a PhD on that instrument from that university. So on harp, I have Robin Cartier, fantastic harpist. So we've got a really fine group there. And then the director of the Philharmonic Glee Club, Philip Field, he's a really great musician as well, great pianist. He used to work with Entume. They've got a very wide range of talents and a lot of experience. So, and they really, all of them are really master musicians. So it's really fun to play with them. I'm really excited to play with them.
You know, you're leaving quite a legacy behind with every of these young musicians that you have brought along through the Jazz Artists in the Schools program. Why do you want to give back so much?
Oh, well, you know, my teachers gave a lot to me. And I really wouldn't be in a position that I am without, you know, help from a number of people. Clem Price and Amiri Baraka being among them. So also, I joined the AACM, the Association for Advancement of Creative Musicians, in Chicago. And one of our tenets was that we had to have community service or, you know, have open workshops. Or we did have a music school for young people. And also our philosophy was that the music had to go outward, you know. So we would have events, let's say on a Sunday afternoon, in a place where you didn't have to serve alcohol in order to have the audience. And so that's kind of part of my background. And then education, just I've been in education a long time, and it's gratifying to see a person that is trying to learn on a certain level or learn about a certain subject, if you can help them, you know, why not?
How many years now have you been teaching at Bloomfield College?
I started there in 1989, so it's about 27 years. Yeah.
That's quite a run.
Yeah.
So you're teaching piano, but you're also teaching some other classes. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I'm teaching beginners, basically people that haven't had instrumental training, or some of them have had it but not on the piano. And we did have an early set of classes in music technology. This Chris White came to the school. Chris White was really great musician, played with Dizzy Gillespie. He's Dizzy's bass player for about 7 years, Nina Simone's bass player. But he was also a really knowledgeable person in terms of technology, because I didn't know a thing about technology. But Chris showed me some things, and then we developed a technology program at Bloomfield College. And it was really unique because most people that go to get a degree in music, they've had instrumental training of some sort, or they go to a music school, they already have some type of knowledge. Well, we were taking in people that didn't know anything about music, but they did have some computer skills. And so we were able to teach them actually how to be into production of music, even CDs and things like that, through software that would show them or teach them the theoretical aspects of music, you know, while I was showing them piano technique. So you have to input the data through a piano keyboard. And so it worked out very well for the people that started with me and then progressed into the music technology. But the other courses that I do now, because I don't do technology now, I just do beginner piano. The other course I do is a world music course, and that's in the fall. And we cover 6 or 7 cultures. We go to Indonesia, China, Africa, Egypt, Ireland, the Middle East, and you know, we try to study the music and the culture, religion, philosophy, and those type of things, geography, political interactions. And then the other course is African American influences, where we are studying basically American music and how it developed in the United States, but what is the African contribution or the contribution of African Americans, and what was the culture prior to coming here in 1619, or you know, prior to interacting with European culture. So those are the two courses I teach other than piano.
We're speaking with Ade Gokay Steve Colson, the pianist, educator, and Bloomfield College professor, about his concert coming up at NJPAC in Newark this Friday, entitled Here Is the Place, Our City, commissioned by NJPAC in honor of Newark's 350th anniversary. What's been the most amazing comment from a student that you've received through the years?
Oh, I get all kind of responses because, you know, it's a big world out there. And a lot of times the students, you know, basically they just come out of high school. Sometimes they've had limited resources or limited experiences. So music is one way that, you know, you can show them or have them experience some other type of culture. But I've had a couple of people say that, you know, I really changed their life, but it's basically by them becoming aware of things from a culture that would be, you know, foreign or strange, but then after we discuss it or, you know, they become involved in it, they start to see how, you know, everything is actually related. At least in today's world, you know, things are very much related.
So after all these years of teaching at the college, being involved with young musicians, and being involved with the Jazz Artists in the Schools program, you know the power of the National Endowment for the Arts.
Yes.
And you know that that's in trouble right now.
Yes.
What do you want to say about that?
It's very disheartening. I actually did get a National Endowment grant when I was starting out. It helped me quite a bit. In fact, I did a piece here in Newark back in 1989. And part of it was because I had been funded a couple of years earlier through the National Endowment. So I know a number of people that have won National Endowment grants. I got one for composition, but people got them for, you know, performance and that type of thing. I don't know if people really appreciate what many artists go through because there's a certain amount of dedication that you have to put in order to get the expertise in your discipline. But there are not a lot of outlets for you to expose the art once you've gotten a product, or there's not necessarily a lot of expendable cash, like people are not in a position to necessarily support you in a way that, you know, would be helpful. So a lot of people have to stop doing what they do in terms of art because you can't sustain yourself. And if you anybody following the record industry, you know that that's just going down the tubes in terms of musicians getting paid because in the old days, you know, you'd make an LP, the person would buy it, they would take it home, and they could listen to it all day, all night, and if somebody else wanted to listen, they'd have to come over to that person's house or they'd have to borrow it. But now, one person can buy a CD and, you know, 100 people can download it, and the musician is basically getting tossed around by piracy or by people downloading things and distributing it. So it's difficult. Then when you see the one mechanism that may be, you know, like a life raft is getting pulled out because there's never been billions of dollars devoted to the National Endowment for the humanities as well. They're talking about eliminating that office. So to me, it's really, you know, civilization, generally you can tell level of civilization by what type of artistic things they're involved in because the arts draw in various disciplines from science, from social studies. That's how we go back and we learn about English society. You know, Shakespeare did plays and you can go back and you can study, or the Greeks did their plays and you can go back and read about it and kind of get a sense of where civilization has gone. So it's such a small amount of money that's been given to it. You're not going to solve these budget problems of billions of dollars or trillions of dollars in debt. You're not going to solve it by taking away, you know, like $50 million from the National Endowment.
So you get 2 minutes with President Trump to sit down just like you and I are talking. What do you say to him?
I'm saying you got to rethink everything. your positions are. He may be saying something is working in terms of getting in office, in terms of politics. But, you know, Max Roach, I worked with Max Roach a bit, and he did a really great record called Percussion Bittersweet. Abby Lincoln is on the record. And they did a song called Mendacity.
Mendacity, mendacity, it makes the world go round. A politician makes a speech and never hears the sound. The campaign trail winds on in towns from coast to coast. The winner ain't the one who's straight, but he who lies the most.
So, you know, we have to kind of grow up a little bit in terms of society and look a little deeper into what people are saying to us. There's a lot of propaganda that goes on, and people just take it as a news. It's actually not news. It's a message that's deceptive, that's designed to draw you into a situation that actually is not to your advantage. But we really should be about helping each other. It's the United States. We're supposed to be looking out for each other. And I don't see that. That's not what I see coming out the Trump administration.
And I'm not making a connection at all, but three names are on one of the CDs that you have together, Tones for Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, and Frederick Douglass.
Yes.
What do they mean to you?
For me, they're really big heroes in terms of what I think people need to do now. You have to resist certain things when they are not correct for you, or when you understand them to not be correct for anybody, you know. But Harriet Tubman is really a great, great person in terms of American history. A lot of people don't realize that she actually led Union troops during the Civil War. She was a spy. She located munitions and told some of the soldiers where they could find it or how they could attack the depot that held those munitions. And she went down into the slave South and freed about 350 people or so on her own by herself, making several trips. But then she also freed several thousand because of the military operations that she was a part of. So she's a big-time hero. There still hasn't been another woman, you know, leading troops in battle. I mean, you know, in actual warfare. Not that I know of, not in American history. Probably Sojourner Truth was probably the best-known female, though, of that era. And she really gave major speeches. Very famous speech, Ain't I a Woman? It's a really famous poem. But they were really brave people, and a lot of persistence and determination at that particular time. And, you know, most people know about Frederick Douglass, just a, you know, magnificent story. He's freed himself, ran away to, I guess it was Newport, and, you know, educated himself, became a great speaker, gave really great speeches, and in the front of the abolitionist movement, and also, which is kind of odd, but he and others were for the women's suffrage movement way back, this is back in the 1800s, so, you know, just fantastic people, you know, working for or on behalf of society.
You know, when I was asked, who would you like to go back in time and interview, someone you didn't get an opportunity, was someone that you first heard when you were about 5 years old that really captured your imagination, that would be Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong, yeah. Dynamite.
Do you remember what song it was?
Blueberry Hill.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill, on Blueberry Hill. When I found you.
And then also, the thing about Louis Armstrong, you know, he's the one that really developed the solo. So, you know, people, I'm not sure that people really understand the level of significance. Musically, when Louis started, people didn't really take solos. You know, if you were in New Orleans, the average person playing what we call jazz, was improvising, they were playing by ear, and the melody was the primary guide. So you listen to the melody, and then by your imagination or by your ear or being familiar with what your other people in the band were playing, you would play certain notes if you were the trombonist or whatever. So you had a certain path laid out for you. But when they would leave the melody, what we would call a solo, well, all of them would solo together. So it wasn't really a solo as we know it. It was a group improvisation. And, you know, you could hear the difference in the texture because you could identify the clarinet versus the trumpet versus the trombone. And so it wasn't hard to distinguish those voices. But Louis Armstrong's the one that got to the point where people realized, hey, maybe we should just let him play and the rest of us, you know, support. Or not play. And so now we have people taking solos, and it's just a normal, you know, routine, everyday thing. But the guy that really started this was Louis Armstrong, you know? And I like to tell people, I believe he's the only guy that stopped the war by himself. Liberia, I believe, was going through a civil war, and Louis Armstrong was scheduled to show up in Liberia. And so when he got there, they said, hey, wait a second. Like, we got to call off the war, right? I mean, I don't believe that. When has that ever happened where a single individual has showed up and everybody calls a truce? So for me, he's just unbelievable. And, you know, so many people come from his style. I mean, he's the one that set the pace. So you have people like Bing Crosby, you know, Frank Sinatra really actually are coming out of the Louis Armstrong book and people like Billie Holiday as well. So phrasing and choice of notes, how to change your phrasing, that comes from Louis Armstrong.
As a Grammy nominee yourself, did you watch the Grammys this year?
I didn't actually watch them this year, no.
Do you care?
I have interest in it, but sometimes, you know, we musicians, we're busy working or doing something else. So a lot of times we have people that we like or that we would like to hear their concert, but we actually are doing something that, you know, required of us. But,
I'm kind of curious because, mm-hmm. you know, you're working with young players all the time and they're exposed to different music than you were.
Yes.
So that mix of, you know, knowing like jazz and then knowing other types of genres of music. Where do you stand with all of that? What do you say to a young musician? Yeah, do your thing. What do mm-hmm. you say to them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because, you know, music changes. And if they want to be in it in terms of professional, they have to kind of know what's going on. But, you know, that's the thing that's funny about music is that there's so much music out there. You're never going to run out of it. I mean, like if a person wanted to study just Chopin, you know, you could do that for, you know, 50 years. So there's no problem. You could study one particular person, one classical person, or one person with a big repertoire in the modern times. But I would tell them, but still try and be diverse because the people like Charlie Parker, for example, he listened to everything. So he was listening to The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky and, you know, arias, you know, Italian opera. He's listened to all of that. And I enjoy it. In fact, in terms of some of the things that I heard at a younger time, there are things like South Pacific, you know, things like that. La Boheme, you know, opera, different operas. And you may not understand the words, but music, you know, it goes beyond the words. So you could follow the storyline and really get a good feeling emotionally or intellectually without having to verbalize everything. So, you know, music, a lot of it is about feeling. And we don't have enough words to get to the subtleties in all of the different feelings. So there's some things that I think can only really be transmitted through some type of abstract art or emotion, such as music. And so I just tell them, you know, listen to what's going on, because they have people of their own age group that are experimenting, that are listening to people that came earlier. And sometimes they use it in a different way. But that's progress. That's always happening.
You know, when you mention Louis Armstrong, I think about how much he liked to record everything in his life,
yes,
including if you go through the museum, there's all kind of recordings, whether at breakfast or not. Mm-hmm. What he could do with today's technology and how he would be looping and how right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he was doing this stuff when people hadn't really thought of it,
yeah,
you know? And he was going, I mean, he was really going around, you know, and taping people. He had his own technology.
Fascinates me.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's really something when you see how, you know, how some of these ideas have been around. Some things have been here and we just don't know about it. But, yeah, that Louis Armstrong, he's something.
We're speaking with pianist and educator Ade Colson, not only about Here Is the Place, Our City, the concert coming up at NJPAC this Friday, but also about Ade's wonderful career. Being born in Newark and playing at a place like the beautiful NJPAC, it's not the first time you've been there, obviously, but does it make your career kind of come all full circle?
Yes, yes, I feel that way. You know, a lot of times, you know, you may be able to do something, but when you're able to go back and repeat, then it's a different level of validation, I think. So I've been very fortunate in those terms. I did, actually with the Myriad, I had an opportunity to write a large piece in dedication to Martin Luther King, which we presented when NJPAC was first opened back in 1998. And they were having what they call the Sing in Praise of King celebration. So they had had 9 celebrations in the city, but there was no structure like an NJPAC where we could have a large, large event. So I got a commission from the New Jersey Chamber Music Society, and I asked Amir Baraka and Richard Wesley, screenwriter, who also lives in Montclair, asked them to contribute something in terms of text. And so then I wrote music to complement both of their submissions. And so we presented that at NJPAC. So, yeah, to come back now, well, we were fortunate we were on the Moody Festival, but this is a little bit different being in the Victoria Theater. And like I say, the lineup of musicians is really nice. And so we're looking forward to it. But I feel very fortunate, to work at NJPAC and to do different things that have turned out for me.
Last night I had the untarnished dream, carried away and up on lavender wings. I felt the wind upon my skin, I felt the power from within. I knew the might, I saw the light, and it was beauty. Last night I had the untarnished dream, now I'm awake, this is a flashback it seems. The world is so much more alive, I feel my spirit has revived. Yes, it was great, I had a date with beauty.
You and your wife, Igwe, both performers. It doesn't always work for people through the years to have a relationship that lasts forever. What's been the magic for you?
I think part of it is we started young, And we were very just fortunate that we were both involved in music enough at that point to where, you know, we felt a certain amount of independence. And so around 1978, we decided we wanted to perhaps make a record. And so then we pursued that and actually put together a record label. And so by 1979, we had our own label. And we produced a record in 79. And, you know, then it's been just traveling because luckily we decided to really pursue it. And by sending records overseas to different countries or around the United States, we had enough people become interested that we were able to start touring. And so we've been traveling internationally since 79. And at that time, I think I hadn't turned 30 yet, and my wife was 25. Yeah, so we were young to be traveling under our own name, and, you know, we did a lot of the major concerts in Europe. And then also that allowed us to have contacts with people in a different kind of a way than a lot of other musicians who are working through an agent or working through some type of organization. We were just doing it ourselves.
When you're not talking about music together, what are you talking about? What's your favorite subject between the two of you?
Oh, well, all type of things. Well, you know, the beauty of it is that we have friends that are also in music or also in different areas. And so the educational piece is one thing because Iqua is actually the supervisor of arts in East Orange, the East Orange District. So she was actually able with several other people to be in on the ground floor of putting together the Cicely Tyson School. And so, you know, Cicely actually does come to the school. When it opened, they had, you know, just phenomenal people come to help open the school with Oprah Winfrey, Lynn Whitfield. It was just crazy, the people that came. So Andrew Young, you know, I got sat around and talked with Andrew Young for a few minutes. So there were some really great people there. Terrence Howard. There were just a number of really great people there. So, but, you know, she's coordinating that type of thing and then coordinating trips because, you know, these young people are very talented. They're going on to college. So we're looking out for them on that level, trying to make sure that they have the right credentials to move on into, you know, a major university or college somewhere. And so we talk a lot about educational issues, you know, how to incorporate music more in the classroom, how to develop lesson plans. Sometimes we're actually consulted for developing what you would call scope and sequence and that type of thing for, you know, a pathway to get to a certain level of mastery in a discipline. So there are a lot of things to work out like that, and they have to deal with a lot of things like student growth. And
why do kids do better when they have music?
Well, they do better when they have music because you got to realize that the average young person doesn't know that their education is serious. They're young people. They don't know. And so you have to get them interested in the subject, but if you try and, I mean, some of them may be interested in math or whatever, you can go directly at it. But the ones that don't see the significance, generally the way you're going to get them to stay in school or become occupied is by making it fun, because that's what they understand, or they don't even understand it, but they do like it. So if you make it fun in some way, or if you make it relevant in some way to their life situation, because like, say, for example, you can talk about math, but you can show them the numbers and they can do the operation. They can add, subtract, whatever. But then if you give them a word problem, they don't know which operation to apply to that problem to solve it, right? So they know how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide, but they don't know which operation or how to construct the word problem into a mathematical formula. So you have to kind of lead them and you have to make it fun. So if they, the ones that I get, because I used to teach the young ones, I started off in elementary school teaching kindergarten, first, second grade. So I did that and then did the middle school and that type of thing. But the fact that they're entering college doesn't change the fact that they still want to have fun, right? So they come into college and you think, okay, let's get serious and you can drive a car and so on and so forth. But that's actually not what's going to hook them in. You got to give them something that's relevant so that they can understand the importance of what they're studying. Otherwise, they feel that it's just something that they're being made to do or that they're being forced to do, and they don't know why. And so you want to get more resistance than, you know, involvement. But music is one way to tap into the expression, because everybody wants to express themselves. And like I say, music will allow you to do that without having words or a particular text that you have to recite. And you can just hum or you can whistle or you can sing without the words, and it will relieve anxieties. Or, you know, in the piano class, I try and get them to kind of block out other sounds. Like some places they'll give you the headphones and now you're in your own isolated world. And what I'm trying to show them is that's good, but you can also block things out by just your mental attitude. So you can just block out the fact that the person next to you on the right and left are playing notes that are different than yours. And then that gets them into understanding that you have to focus. And if you can get them there, the next step is to try and ease them into a form of meditation. In terms of music, if you get into a meditative state, you know, your brain waves will shift. And, you know, how you act or how you live is how you think. So if you can modify that brain wave and get a certain level of calm, it's easier to focus on what you're doing. But the other thing that's interesting is you actually learn more when you're having fun. So even if you wanted to be serious and you were serious, they would still learn more if it's fun, right? So for me, the bottom line is let's see if it's fun. And then anything we can add on after that, you know, is like just icing on the cake, you know?
It's obviously been working for you. I think I know the answer to this because I've certainly enjoyed my time teaching at Bloomfield College. But you could teach a lot of places. Why spend such a long time at Bloomfield College?
Oh, well, you know, actually, it's just very good for me. And I was invited to come to the college by President Noonan. It's kind of a funny story because I never applied for the job, right? I was playing in Amiri Baraka's basement, and it was a poetry night where there are about 7 or 8 women poets. In fact, one of them was Jane Cortez, who's married to Ornette Coleman. And so I was playing behind the poets, and two gentlemen came in and sat down. And one was Jack Noonan. He was president of Bloomfield College. And the other was Clarence Seniors. He was a trustee. And so after we broke for the intermission, they said, hey, you know, we'll talk to you for a minute. And so they proposed that I come to the college because they were looking at ways of increasing student retention, right? And so they were saying, we're going to start this program and we're going to have in fact, that's where it goes back to the NEA. We're going to have arts, right? We're going to have these different arts, and that's going to invigorate the student, and that's going to make them feel comfortable or something that's enjoyable that will cause them to want to stay at the school and then put in the time on the subjects that maybe they don't like so much, right? So I said, okay, you know, and so I went to the meeting, and that was way back in 1989. So I went to the meeting, and it was just interesting to me, and they had a very diverse student population. And it's close to me. I'm in Montclair. I drive about 10 minutes. I'm there on campus. So I said, well, you know, it's hard to beat this. I was working in New York for several years, but it was a two-hour drive all the way over and then two-hour drive back. And I started thinking, well, you know, 4 hours versus, you know, 15 minutes up the street. The students are, and like I say, with Chris, we had a program going there where these students, they didn't have to have a musical background at all. And we were actually getting them music degrees. They were coming out with a music degree in technology. They actually, by the time they got done, they actually could read, you know, music notation. Some of them got to be pretty good instrumentalists. So for me, hard to pass on that because I was approached and I was asked to come, and it's been enjoyable ever since. So I don't try and mess with it, you know, because it's been just nothing but positive.
This is April, Jazz Appreciation Month. Mm-hmm. Not only your concert at NJPAC coming up on Friday, that is dedicated to the late Dr. Clement Price and the late Amiri Baraka. Here is the place, Our City, is the name of the piece that you'll be performing at NJPAC on Friday. Jazz Appreciation Month. When I say jazz, what's your definition of jazz?
Oh, jazz. Well, you know, jazz is the original art form that comes out of the United States by way of the African-American experience. A lot of us, particularly in the ASM or Duke Ellington, some other guys said that they would prefer to call it the music of so-and-so. I remember Max Roach pulled me aside several times. He said, you know, let's call it the music of Dizzy Gillespie, you know, the music of Charlie Parker, the music of Charles Mingus. So, you know, we recognize the word jazz, but then the ACM, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, some of my heroes as well, Lester Bowie and Joseph Jarman, Roscoe Mitchell, Malachi Favors, and Famadou Damoye, the really great guys. They say great black music, and the guys in the ACM, Muha Richard Abrams, Henry Threadgill, George Lewis, a lot of guys, Douglas Hewitt, Cahill El-Zabbar, some guys that were really great in terms of helping me to form my own musical identity. That's the banner that they put up because we'd like to understand the history of it, which is tied into the black experience in the United States.
You know, I had the opportunity with my Sports Jam program to have Amiri Baraka talk about his love of sports, talking about going to the football game with his dad and watching Emlyn Tennell of the New York Giants, the only black player on the team at that time. We had a wonderful time. Was he misunderstood by many people? Does everybody know the real Amiri Baraka? You spent a lot of time with him. What don't we know about him? What do we need to know? Obviously, his son Raz, now the mayor of Newark. What do we need to know about Amiri that we never found out?
Oh, okay. Now, Amiri is a really great man. You know, great in several fields. You know, great as a poet. I don't think, for me, he's the greatest poet that I know of. I don't know of anybody, unless you want to go back and talk about Shakespeare or something like that. Other than that, to me, he's number one in the English language in terms of describing things and having his finger on the pulse of what's going on. Now, I think he's misunderstood because sometimes he was very sharp in his criticism. And I think also people looked at the fact that he was communist and he had communist views. And they would say, well, you know, so you're anti-American. Or if he criticized something in terms of when he saw elements of racism, they said, well, you're mistaken. So I think in some ways he's maligned because of those two things. But Amiri was fond of people. And if you go to his house, you see all types of people, all walks of life. Because Amiri, you know, he called it like he saw it, you know, so you could rely on him because of integrity. And his integrity got him in trouble. I think one reason that he had problems is because, you know, he wasn't going to fool around with the truth as he saw it, and he was going to call it, you know, like he saw it. So, you know, he's ready to put in the work. If he asks somebody else to work, I'm sure he's working just as hard, if not harder. And, you know, he's just a great individual in terms of his vision and able to understand, you know, the ebb and flow of history or politics. And one thing that people should know is he was absolutely hilarious. If you listen to some of his poems, I mean, he's a genius. That's what he is. He's a literary genius.
So you can go in the Wayback Machine, or you can stay right here in 2017. One piano player, you get one opportunity to see play. Who do you want to go see play?
It's Art Tatum, you know. It's Art Tatum is just, it's ridiculous what he would do with piano. So, you know, just ridiculous, you know. I was so fortunate, though. I mean, I've met some really, really great musicians. I mean, Oscar Peterson and Finest Newborn are about the closest you can get to Art Tatum, as far as I can see. And I was able to meet and hang out with both of them. And, you know, Oscar Peterson is just a marvelous, just unbelievable. I mean, if you look on any of his stuff, like it's on YouTube or buy his records, it's just what he's playing on the piano is just, it's unbelievable, you know? The control, dexterity, the range of techniques, you know? But Finest Newborn, very similar. Those are the closest people, I guess, in terms of a person that I, you know, never met and just came along too late to have met them. But Art Tatum, first of all, Ragtime, when it went to Stride, those guys that played Stride piano were just really magnificent people. Like Willie Lyon Smith, we did a project for Willie Lyon Smith right here. He used to play in Newark all the time. And he taught people like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Fats Waller. And those people would come to town, to Newark, just to kind of hang out and, you know, see what he was going to show him. And then Dave Lambert was up in Orange. I didn't realize that I was about five blocks from him. He was playing in a place called Wallace's every weekend. And I could have walked there in 10 minutes, but I didn't know he was there. And, you know, he would play two songs in two different keys in Stride style. So, you know, if I had known, right, it would have been him. But other than that, it's Art Tatum.
So as you look out into the NJ Pack audience this Friday night and you see a fellow musician who you've known for a long time and you see the head bobbing, nodding in appreciation, and then you see a young kid who you've never met before doing the same thing, mm-hmm. What means more?
Ooh. Well, I guess the younger person, because then it's being carried forward. Because, you know, the thing is, they've done the studies and things like this, and they find that if a person is not introduced to certain aspects of culture at a young age, by the time they get to about maybe 14 or 15, they don't see the need for it because they've existed that far without it, and they've got other interests. And so if you try and introduce it then, you know, maybe they'll go for it, maybe they won't. But if you introduce things, you know, at an earlier stage, it's much more natural part of the person's concepts, right? And so in terms of, improvised music, there aren't that many radio stations playing jazz. No television shows. At one point, they did have a few shows. Or at least when you have variety shows back then, you might have an act come on and you could understand that in context with the other acts, you know. But now you'd almost have to be specifically looking for jazz in order to go seek it out. So that's a problem because it's not just a normal everyday routine part of what you might hear. So yeah, for the younger person to tap their foot and be interested in an older form of music, right, when everything is saying, okay, hip-hop is your music and, you know, rap is the style that you should listen to. And obviously they will have, musical heroes and things in that genre, but it's good to know that they can also go back, just like I would go back and listen to Beethoven or listen to Bach, if they can go back and listen to some of the earlier masters in whatever style it might happen to be.
I could always dribble a basketball with my left hand, even though I was right-handed, mm-hmm. right? I can swing a hockey stick left-handed. When it comes to playing a piano, this left hand has no idea what to do. Can you teach that, or is it some people that can't get that other hand going? What's that all about?
Well, yeah, that's something, yeah, that you have to spend time with. And that's another aspect we're trying to do in class, because we actually do have a right and a left side, right? And your right side is controlled by the left brain and vice versa. Left side is controlled by the right brain. So most of us are right-handed. So left-handed people a lot of times have an advantage in piano playing because they can play the chords very easily. And the right hand is more configured so they can handle that anyway. But if we're right-handed, and that's the dominant side in society, we sit at the piano and our left hand is just not happening. So part of it is just training again and, you know, trying to get the hand to respond. It's just like anything else. You have to focus on that part. Like, say, if you're learning a piece and there's a certain measure where you keep making a mistake, you don't keep playing the other measure. You just go to that place where the mistake occurs, right? So you have to take your left hand and actually work the left hand by itself and, you know, watch and see what it's doing and then try and get, you know, conscientious about what you want it to do. And then, you know, practice and practice slowly. And gradually, you know, it's a matter of getting your thoughts to translate to the muscle. And so if you do it repeatedly, after a while, you know, it will respond, you know, it'll do it. But I've been working on the left hand for a long, long time, and I'm still trying to get it together, right? But if you play ragtime pieces, that's one way to do it, because that's part of what's in the music, you know, that's the element that's in there that you have to deal with. Whereas in classical music, you don't have that same motion of reaching for the low note and then playing a chord. You may have it in some pieces, but it's not as strenuous. So, you know, the early ragtime pieces, if you get an early ragtime book, Scott Joplin or UB Blake, people like that. So when I get a student to that level, that's the first thing I do is I take them to learn some of those ragtime pieces like Fizz Water or Maple Leaf Rag or whatever it might be.
We look forward to Here Is the Place, Our City at NJPAC during this Jazz Appreciation Month. It's been fun. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Doug.